As they sometimes say in politics, never mind.
You know, I readily admit that this was a huge error on my part in seeing what is obvious, which is that for 30 years I've been myself, and it's going to be, would be virtually impossible for me to step into a situation where I couldn't be myself.
Bipartisanship takes another hit as Republican New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg takes himself out of consideration to be Secretary of Commerce in the Obama administration. It's an identity crisis for one confused senator.
I gotta be me.
Well, of course he does. Bipartisanship back to the drawing board. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. It's Friday the 13th, 2009. Today, we'll discuss the problems facing American banks. Do the math. They could be insolvent. Deployment of new troops to Afghanistan. Violence among teenage romances. It's not a Valentine's Day story, but it's a big story. Those coming up. But first, Richard Hake is filling in for Femi Oke today. The latest news begins in the suburbs of Buffalo, New York.
That's right, John. Federal investigators are expected on the scene of a continental commuter plane crash just outside of Buffalo. It was on a approach to Buffalo's airport. It crashed into a house while coming in for a landing. All 48 people on board were killed. Here's Erie County Executive Chris Collins at a news conference earlier this morning.
Unfortunately, there was a town resident in the one home that perished, and two individuals were able to escape that home and with very minor injuries went to ECMC.
So 49 people in that crash died. It's the nation's first fatal commercial airline crash in 2.5 years. Well, John, as you mentioned, it's the job President Obama just can't seem to fill. As John mentioned, New Hampshire Republican Senator Judd Gregg doesn't want to be the next Commerce Secretary. The president says the senator's withdrawal won't deter him from trying to work with the GOP.
The one thing I want to make sure of is people don't take from this the notion that we can't get Democrats and Republicans working together.
The president first tapped a Democrat for the job, New Mexico's Governor Bill Richardson. He withdrew a month ago amid a federal investigation about his links to big business. Meanwhile, Senator Gregg says the $789 billion stimulus wasn't the only reason he withdrew, but it was definitely part of it. House lawmakers have their qualms about the revised bill, too. They were supposed to vote on it yesterday, but said they needed time to read the new plan. A vote may come in both the House and Senate today. And there's been another deadly bombing attack against Shiite pilgrims in Iraq. Iraqi police say 35 people were killed and dozens more injured in an attack against pilgrims south of Baghdad. Australian police have charged a man with the deliberate lighting of one of those deadly wildfires that tore through the country's south. The man also faces child pornography possession charges. The suspect's lawyer says he was in a fragile mental state at the time.
Crazy stories. And 180 people died in those wildfires, many of which were deliberately set. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Dow slipped a little yesterday. The S&P begins trading at 835. On Valentine's Day, who has it better, people in a relationship or people who are not? Couples or single? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And keep your stimulus suggestions coming. We're getting great suggestions. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're following a number of stories this morning. First of all, of course, federal investigators are in the suburbs of Buffalo, New York, to look into the crash of a commuter plane. It's flight 3407, Continental commuter plane from Newark to Buffalo. It crashed, killed all 48 people on board and one person on the ground. The plane landed on a house. It's the nation's first fatal commercial airliner crash in 2.5 years, and we are watching those developments. And we're going to take a deep look at what's going on in Afghanistan and South Asia today. Very important issue. issues for the Obama administration, and more coming up. But the third time is the charm, as we mentioned, for President Obama. Once again on the prowl for a commerce secretary, Senator Judd Gregg pulled out, a Republican. He said he just had to be himself. It was kind of an identity crisis for him.
Not you. It's me.
You're giving me the it's not you, it's me routine?
That, of course, is not Republican Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire. That's a Seinfeld. But it was a you, me, who is who. Bipartisanship takes another hit. We're going to have more on that in the program as well. But we begin with Steve Lohr of the New York Times thinking about the financial bailout. Eight bankers, you may recall, were up on Capitol Hill this week facing lawmakers. It was quite a confrontation. But there's really a discussion behind the scenes in the administration of whether these banks in the United States that we're trying to save are actually too far gone to save, essentially insolvent. Maybe we have a banking system that is fundamentally not able to pay its bills. First of all, Steve Lohr, thanks for coming into the studio. If you do the math, are the banks in the United States essentially insolvent?
Some of them are. The assessment that we did was to take a look at this issue, talk to a bunch of financial economists, and basically where they come out is that if you look at the system as a whole, and the current trends of unrecognized losses, the answer is probably yes.
Wow. Let's talk about this term insolvency. It is a bit of a term of art. I mean, if somebody came to me tomorrow and said, pay everything you owe today, and I said no, I'm insolvent. In many ways, if you do the math, almost everyone is insolvent almost all the time if they had to pay off all their debts. How do you calculate it here?
Yeah, and there are differences. I mean, it's the common sense business definition is that you're, as you're saying, John, that your liabilities exceed your assets. In banking terms, they look at this in terms of in this context of these the rising losses from these bad loans and toxic securities overwhelming their assets. So it's similar but a little bit different. And the issue here is that unless you resolve that problem, the banks are not going to lend as we hope they do, and the sort of wheels of commerce don't keep moving. Mm-hmm. So this is ultimately not about the banks. It's about the economy and people.
Let's try to do the math here. And, there's categories of assets.
Sure.
And I wonder if you could separate them. There are the really bad assets. There are the assets that actually look like bad assets, but if you look closely at them, they're actually really good. Then there are good assets, stuff like stocks and bonds that actually aren't really affected
treasury
by this.
Treasury bonds,
sure, that sort of thing. I heard a number last week from an economist that said that if you add up all the sort of questionable assets and liabilities in the system, it's like something like $655 trillion against the entire economy in the world of 50 $55 trillion. How do you deal with a number like that?
That one is those kinds of estimates are not what we were trafficking in here. Most of those, I think, come from the face value of some of these complex insurance products, for example. The most recent estimates, and the reason I did this story, I was asked to take a look at the issue. How should we think about it? And this is a news analysis piece that I wrote.
And thank goodness you did, actually. Yeah,
but is that we people like Noriel Roubini, who's an NYU economist, have looked at this, and he's been pessimistic in the past, but he's been right, if you look at the snapshot of the current situation, the banks in total have $3 trillion what are very likely, by his assessment, losses yet to be recognized. About $1.8 trillion is held by the U.S. banks. The rest is by other financial institutions, and particularly Europe and other banks around the world. That gets you to $1.8 trillion. And his view, and that of others, is that the whole, if you will, the balance sheet of American banks is on the order of $1 trillion.
Now, part of the question of solvency is if the clock ticks long enough, if there's a long enough time for the payback, everything's going to be okay. If it comes to term shorter, then there's a real catastrophe. How does the timeline look?
At present, the timeline looks pretty lousy, which is with a deteriorating economy. But that is precisely the point and what all the bankers will tell you. And this, in banking terms, this is called forbearance, which is basically the time will heal. And in some past crises, that has certainly been the case. In the early 80s, in the Latin debt crisis, the nine money center banks had were at risk for more than three times their capital. They weren't forced to mark to market, you know, today's prices on those loans, and they came out.
They came out fine.
They had losses, but it wasn't catastrophic. And we sort of did the same thing with savings and loan.
Can the government and the Obama administration basically extend the timeline here? Is that their main lever?
Yes, but they don't want to, because unless you solve this issue of these bad assets, we're not going to get the kind of lending we need to get the economy going. So their proposal this week was to set up this public-private fund to essentially create a market and put up, you know, to get prices and get the for these bad assets and get them off the bank's books. Most people, or a number of the experts that I talk to, think this is inadequate. That ultimately, the government's going to have to go in, separate the good from the bad banks, take the bad assets and sell them off again as we did in the resolution trust, in the savings and loan case.
Some of those banks did not come back, except now we're talking about the big banks tiptoeing on the edge of insolvency. We're going to have to say it out loud if we have any chance of dealing with this financial crisis. Steve Lohr, thanks so much for providing some clarity there.
Thanks, sir.
Steve Lohr is a New York Times reporter whose current piece in the New York Times is all about calculating whether the banks are not just bad, but fundamentally insolvent. Now, this hour, we're also going to take a look at something that's very, very important to the new administration, the situation in South Asia. We begin in Afghanistan, Kabul, Afghanistan, where the BBC's Afghanistan reporter Martin Patience is, coinciding with the arrival of U.S. envoy Richard Holbrooke, who is in Kabul. It's described as a fact-finding mission. Martin Patience, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, Holbrooke, in advance of his trip to Afghanistan, has described the situation in Afghanistan as much more complicated than Iraq, the most serious foreign policy situation. I'm paraphrasing here. Is that a response to reality in Afghanistan, or is it perhaps an attempt to make Holbrooke's status as an envoy look a little more prominent than it might be?
Well, I think it's two things. I think first of all, he also called it a mess. I think it's realizing the magnitude of problems here. The security situation is getting worse. There's a lot of corruption in the Afghan government, and many Afghans just feel that things aren't getting better. So I think by making these types of comments, Richard Holbrooke is raising the issue that this is incredibly complex, but he's also very blunt. He's a very blunt man, and I think that's one of the reasons why he's been chosen for this job, because he will knock heads. And I think there's a real sense that things need to start moving very quickly in Afghanistan, otherwise the whole kind of project, the whole effort could end up slipping away in the coming years.
Well, Martin, is the first head to be knocked then that of Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who controls the central part of the country but not much more?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, certainly American officials have been incredibly critical of the Afghan government in recent months. In fact, with Barack Obama's new administration, we've seen a kind of tougher line. For example, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, said that Afghanistan is a narco state. So I think there's a real sense that Hamid Karzai must tackle corruption. He must do more to try and promote good governance in order to try and win over the trust of the Afghan population, who are deeply mistrustful of their government. I mean, that's one element. The other element, obviously, is that the international community, there's a feeling that they need to be more coordinated and perhaps do more in order to get the security situation right, obviously alongside with the Afghan security forces.
That was Martin Patience from our partner, the BBC, in an interview recorded earlier this morning. He's in Kabul. We're going to hear more from Martin. And we'll also continue our conversation, adding the voice of Parag Khanna, who's a fellow at the New America Foundation. It's not just Afghanistan in South Asia that is of importance to the Obama administration. And as we pointed out, Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. envoy to Afghanistan and South Asia, there are many issues on the table in Pakistan, in India, fallout from the attacks in Mumbai, as well as the prospect of a perhaps doubling of the troops on the part of the U.S. and NATO inside Afghanistan. All that when we come back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So how important are the issues in South Asia to the new Obama administration? We're continuing our discussion of Afghanistan, India, and Pakistan. And listen here now to Dennis Blair, Director of National Intelligence, testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee.
No improvement is possible in Afghanistan without Pakistan taking control of its border areas, improving governance, and creating economic and educational opportunities throughout the country.
There's the challenge, according to Dennis Blair, Director of National Intelligence. And we've been talking about it with the BBC's Martin Patience, who is in Kabul, Afghanistan, about U.S. envoy Richard Holbrooke's visit to that country. Joining us is Parag Khanna, Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation and author of The Second World, who is in Washington, D.C. Parag, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Martin, let me just a quick question to you. Is there a sign, and Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. envoy, has been in the region for a while now, that there is increased cooperation or any change in what was a tense situation in the waning days of the Bush administration between Pakistan and the United States and NATO forces in Afghanistan, Martin?
Well, certainly I was out there a couple of months ago right on the border, and it was very interesting speaking to American commanders. They said that certainly cooperation between American commanders and Pakistani commanders had improved, but there's no doubt that Taliban and other Al-Qaeda militants still operate in those tribal areas, and it's from those tribal areas that many of the attacks inside Afghanistan are launched and plotted from there. So obviously that's of great concern to all the international community as well as the Afghan government, that you need to try and address that problem. You need to attack a Taliban camps just across the border in order to make a security difference inside Afghanistan.
Parag Khanna, it seems to me that if we were speaking back closer to the Mumbai attacks in India around Thanksgiving, that most analysts were suspecting that a trend of instability was developing both in India and especially in Pakistan. But based on some interesting reports yesterday that Pakistan is aggressively pursuing the suspects who are Pakistanis in the Mumbai attacks, that the trend seems to be exactly in reverse, that we're seeing stability among the civilian governments, restraint among the militaries on both sides in India and Pakistan. And even if you're looking at the Afghanistan example here, Pakistan looks like a much more cooperative ally of the United States than was even believed possible a few months ago. Do I have that wrong, Parag?
Well, I would say it's just too early to tell. These right. things vacillate a great deal. There's a joke amongst the community of people who look at this, which is that we always get Al-Qaeda's number three guy from Pakistan, which is to say that they're always handing over someone in cooperation. But how deep is the cooperation, really, and what other objectives and agendas do they have going on? Yes, with the Mumbai attacks, it's clear that they've apprehended a number of the suspects, but I wouldn't call it an aggressive investigation. They already had a number of people quite soon, in fact, in custody, and the dossier that was put together by the Indians was quite harsh and revealing about the situation. So it was definitely, Pakistan seems to be caught red-handed in this one to some extent. I also want to agree with the speaker's comment about the instability that is threatening Afghanistan from Taliban activities that are being planned by various factions in the tribal areas of Pakistan. This is also affecting Pakistan in the other direction, which is to say that a lot of the suicide bombings, the seizure of the Swat Valley by one particular group, those are also a phenomenon emanating from the tribal areas. So it's as I described in an article recently, it's like squeezing a balloon on one side, it just inflates in the other. So we need a sort of multi-directional strategy to deal with this.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, you describe, and there are many others have suggested, the cynical quality of the way Pakistan deals with both the situation in Afghanistan and apprehending so-called suspects in the Mumbai attack. How do you sort out the symbolic from the real? And is it conceivable that India and Pakistan could be on a cooperative enough footing to have a multilateral impact inside the much more unstable Afghanistan? Parag?
Well, it's the cooperation first and foremost just simply extends to what you mentioned earlier, which is restraint over Kashmir. It's not diverting military assets away from the Afghan-Pakistan border towards Kashmir in terms of Pakistani decision-making, and India not exacerbating the situation by sending its troops to the Pakistani border. So Indian restraint has a direct consequence on Pakistan's ability to focus on the agenda that the United States wants it to, which is, of course, dealing with the Taliban on its Afghan border. And then in terms of Indian activity and cooperation with others, it's simply more a question of what will India's military or otherwise role be in stabilizing Afghanistan. They provide a lot of assistance, a lot of advisors, a certain number of infrastructure projects, and I'm sure we'll get to this, but India has built a major road in western Afghanistan, which is now probably going to become a major NATO supply route, given that the routes in Pakistan have become very dangerous.
Well, you know, it's interesting because you describe a dynamic which could be very positive, but as you say, it will remain to be seen whether that advantage is, whether it is taken advantage of. Martin Patience, before we go, just quickly, Richard Holbrooke in Afghanistan, is he likely to say anything today that would address this broader bilateral issue between India and Pakistan?
Well, no, he's stressing, his aides are stressing very much so that this is a fact-finding mission, and with no indication that there's going to be public comments on this. Certainly he's going to spend a few days here, then we think he'll be moving on to India, then back to Washington, where we expect he'll be formulating new policy to try and deal with Afghanistan in the regional context. And obviously I think that'll become very prominent ahead of the NATO summit, which is the beginning of April.
Well, there you go. Three players, two big, one little, India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, but all have the potential of accomplishing something, as Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. envoy, is in the region. The BBC's Martin Patience, thank you very much from Kabul. Parag Khanna, senior research fellow at the New America Foundation, thanks to you, author of The Second World. He joined us from Washington, D.C. Parag, thank you. And we have headlines now from Richard Hake.
And John, they're starting to sort things out in a suburb just outside of Buffalo. A Continental commuter plane coming in for a landing nosedived into a house in suburban Buffalo, sparking a fiery explosion. It killed all 49 people on board the aircraft, as well as a person in the house. Mary Jane Luce lives near the site of the crash. She told CBS that she kept her distance at first.
We could see the house, actually, and the fire, but there were so many explosions and so many little bits of ash and stuff blowing out that you didn't want to get close.
The National Transportation Safety Board is now on the scene. The model of the plane that crashed has been involved in 13 other incidents, though none of them were fatal. 2 years ago, Sweden grounded its fleet of this plane, citing landing gear problems. In other stories, Zimbabwe's new Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai is set to swear in a new cabinet. He was brought into President Robert Mugabe's government this week, ending nearly a year of political struggle between the opposition and ruling parties. The opposition party will get finance and health posts in the cabinet. Posts for defense and foreign affairs will go to Mugabe's party. And Valentine's Day is tomorrow, and scientists have found that being in love is kind of like being addicted. Scientists at Rutgers studied the brains of recently heartbroken people and found the brain mimics cravings like you're on drugs.
We're addicts. That's the solution.
That's
Thank you, Richard.
Where'd the candy go?
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I guess you could say it's not your average public radio story, but it's the big discussion around the dinner table in my house. My 10-year-olds and 7-year-olds are, I think it's fair to say, obsessed with the story of 19-year-old teen pop star Chris Brown and what may or may not have happened with his girlfriend, pop star Rihanna. My girls are big fans of Rihanna, and it's possible that the pop star Chris Brown will face charges for allegedly assaulting and threatening his girlfriend Rihanna. But it may go further. I mean, kids are talking about the story, but the Rihanna story may also be an indication that there's a lot more going on in some teenage and young people's relationships, bordering on violence, and that should be something that maybe we should all be paying more attention to. A culture of violence in young couples. Joining this discussion is Charles Blow, op-ed columnist with the New York Times. Charles Blow, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
So this relationship erupts, but you say it's not atypical based on the kinds of things you're looking at.
No. There are about 10% of all children between in ninth grade and 12th grade say that their boyfriend or girlfriend in the last 12 months has hit, slapped, or hurt them on purpose. So that's 10% of the population. And that number has risen slightly over the years. I think they started taking this measure in 1999. And the last time they did the survey, it was at the highest level it had ever been since the time they started taking the survey.
Now, is this because of inputs that relate to family stress or parental behavior, or is this a culture of violence that's developing within the community of young people here?
I think it's all of those things. Part of it is that, you know, the media has made them accustomed to the idea that hitting is okay. You know, in movies you see people slap people and who are hysterical, and then they straighten up. You see a lot of violence in the people who are the stars of movies, whether they be action heroes or what have you. So there becomes a culture of violence. In addition to that, there were other kind of interesting social trends that are tracking with this that are going in opposite directions. So that 10% number may actually be lower than the real prevalence of this violence.
Really? Hmm.
One of the reasons is that the universe of daters is shrinking, even as this number of people who say their boyfriend or girlfriend has hit them is going up.
Now, what does that mean?
That means that there's a group called Child Trends that tracks the prevalence of dating among teenagers.
Right.
And over the same period, from 1999 to present, they have seen a dramatic drop in the percentage of 12th graders who say that they date frequently, and a dramatic increase in the frequency of those who say that they never date.
Now, that's not because they've taken up chess or anything, is it?
Not at all. That's part of what they call the hookup culture. Kids are less and less likely to pair off individually for what we would consider an official date, and they're less and less likely to identify another person as a boyfriend or girlfriend.
So it's another category of being single.
Right.
It's single, devoid of relationship,
right,
but very sexually active.
Right. And so there's a semantic difference in the way that they're asking the question. And in fact, the CDC, who asked the question on violence, admits as much, because they never ask the kids whether or not you have a boyfriend or girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they say that some of the no category could in fact be people who were hit but don't have someone who they would officially label a boyfriend or girlfriend.
Well, this creates an interpretive problem. I mean, you know, I was looking at Chris Brown, of course, has these fabulous videos. He's an incredible dancer. He's got hit music and has been in movies. And I was shocked that he's only 19.
Yes.
And Rihanna is about as young.
She's 20.
She's 20. Right. And, of course, she is a very talented musician who had that great hit Umbrella a couple of summers ago that I still can't get out of my head.
I don't think anyone
head.
Can get that.
Yeah.
My
kids play it all the time. You know, for two people who are in such a celebrity spotlight, it's an additional pressure.
I think that's probably true. But I think that what this highlights is that this violence stretches across kind of all kind of social economic categories. It stretches across all kind of racial barriers. It's prevalent in every category, and I think that's important for people to realize.
And Chris Brown has also lost endorsements as a result of this. There's been a real serious backlash. Could this be, because celebrities, of course, are followed so much, particularly by young people, an opportunity to focus on domestic violence and violence among teenagers?
I absolutely think so. It's ironic that this happened this Sunday. It was right on the tail end of, you know, teen Violence and Dating Awareness Week was last week, and it kind of happened. So it does point the spotlight on that issue,
and could possibly be a positive opportunity for education. I don't want to say teachable moment; it's so public radio to say that. But Charles Blow, thanks so much for sharing that information.
Sure.
Charles Blow, op-ed columnist with the New York Times. Well, they're no longer a couple. Chris Brown and Elmo there on a show that he's probably not going to be on anytime soon. Richard Hake has the headlines.
And John, we're starting to learn about the identities of some of those who died in that continental commuter plane crash just outside of Buffalo, New York last night. 50 people died. 49 people were on the plane, 44 passengers, 5 crew members, and one person on the ground who was in the house where the plane crashed down to. We understand that one of the passengers was a woman whose husband died in the September 11th tragedy.
Oh, get out.
And a news conference is expected very soon, within the hour, on this crash, and we will monitor that and bring you the latest.
Oh, I don't even want to think about that. Anyway, what else is going on?
Well, the head of the White House Economics Council, Larry Summers, says himself that the stimulus bill is no silver bullet. Summers says it will help revive consumer spending, but he warns that the economy is going to take time to fix. President Obama looking for yet another person to be his commerce secretary. His last pick, Republican junior Senator Judd Gregg from New Hampshire, held a press conference yesterday to say that he's withdrawing. He told Politico that after much consideration, he could not be a team player in an Obama administration. Gregg had not yet resigned his Senate seat, though he said yesterday he probably won't seek re-election in the year 2010. In Luzerne County, Pennsylvania, I don't know if you heard about this, two judges, Mark Cavarella and Michael Conahan, have pleaded guilty to fraud for taking more than $2.6 million in kickbacks. Now, to get this, to send teenagers to privately run youth detention centers in the area.
This is a fascinating story. We actually may get more on this later this morning. But so the idea is they're steering defendants into a facility that gets state reimbursement for having more inmates?
Right. And then they get money. They get money if they send the kid to juvenile hall.
That's monstrous.
Now, the Pennsylvania...
These are allegations, though, right?
Yeah. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has appointed a senior judge to review this and review as many as 2,000 juvenile cases over which the judges presided over since the year 2003. Both judges have been suspended, and they face more than 7 years in prison if convicted.
That'll be an interesting trial and an interesting investigation. As you say, the investigation is going on.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you, Richard Hake.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Listen now to President Barack Obama in Peoria, Illinois, on the 12th of February. That's yesterday.
Once Congress passes this plan, and I sign it into law, a new wave of innovation, activity, and construction will be unleashed all across America.
Joining us now is Chad Knoll, former engine assembler with the Caterpillar Corporation in Peoria. Chad, any sign of that wave of innovation, activity, and construction from where you sit?
Not really. Our plant is going to be moving to Texas, and so that it won't help our jobs at all. They are already gone.
And you were laid off about 2 weeks ago, is that right?
That's correct.
How long have you been with the Caterpillar Corporation?
Almost 4 years.
And, Caterpillar is really an economic indicator of construction activity, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. As you see these reports of a stimulus package and all of the money that's earmarked for restarting the economy and saving jobs, is there anything tangible in there for you as far as you can see?
No, not for me, because we were informed that our plant will not come back. So it's not going to help me specifically, but it may help other. We have other plants here in Illinois, so it may help them out, but not us.
So you've got a choice then. As an engine assembler, you can go to another community where they assemble engines or do that kind of manufacturing, or you can sign up for some retraining. How's that thought process going in your brain right now?
Well, I'm not gonna try to go to another plant. It's too far away from where I live, and I don't relocate. And as far as training, they never specifically told me anything about that. I mean, never gave us a chance that we're going to be able to retrain. So my hopes aren't high for anything, really, about getting my job back.
You know, Chad, the president has said that we have to kind of work together in our communities and keep a sense of despair from taking over. I understand you're just right in the aftershock of losing your job. But can you give any of us here who maybe still have our jobs and are holding on with pins and needles some advice about handling this particular moment?
Well, I can't because, like I said, 2 weeks ago, we came into work and we were supposed to be laid off February 20th was our last day. Well, they laid us off 3 weeks earlier than that, so didn't have a chance to, say goodbye to hardly anybody. So, I mean, they kind of screwed us there. So, I don't have anything I can say about that. They just did it so quick and unexpected that it was no time to think about it.
Well, you're thinking now, quickly before we go, is there any first step that at least you can put on the horizon?
I have applied to one job already.
What is it? What is it?
It is a fairly similar thing. It's for another engine, I won't say, but another engine assembly place. But
probably a lot of applications in there with you, right, in the community,
yeah.
Chad. Well, we can hear I think it's fair to say, trauma and uncertainty in your voice about what to do over the next few weeks. Good luck to you, Chad Knoll.
All right, thank you very much.
Chad Knoll's a former engine assembler with Caterpillar in the town where Barack Obama was talking about a wave of innovation coming. He doesn't see it yet.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A question. Which is better, being single or being in a relationship for Valentine's Day, which is tomorrow? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Single or a couple? You decide which is better. And now headlines from Richard Hake joining us for Femi. Okay.
John, witnesses report a sputtering sound before a commuter plane crashed into a house near Buffalo, New York last night. All 49 people on board were killed, as well as a man in the home. But two others inside that house were able to escape. A crash occurred in light snow and fog. We expect to get a briefing very soon from the National Transportation Safety Board. Meanwhile, President Obama is expressing his condolences to the families of people lost in that crash. The state of Texas has recalled all products from a peanut corporation plant. It's the latest development in the nationwide salmonella outbreak. Texas health officials say inspectors found dead rodents and feathers there. The company's under federal criminal investigation. The outbreak has sickened some 600 people. A female suicide bomber has killed 35 people and wounded dozens more just south of Baghdad. The bomber attacked a procession of hundreds of Shiite pilgrims. And the chief of Russia's mission control says clouds of debris from the collision between U.S. and Russian communications satellites will circle Earth for thousands of years and threaten numerous other satellites.
More garbage. Thank you, Richard.
Space Hague. Junk.
In a moment, how to deliver morally sensitive messages to cell phones where kids watch the small screen. But we first turn to our friend Josh Rogers, reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord, on the line to talk about the decision by Republican Senator Judd Gregg to take his name out of consideration as Commerce Secretary. Josh, is this a reveal about your senator or more about something going on in the Obama administration that made the Republican senator pull back?
I mean, perhaps a bit of both. It's strange. You know, Judd Gregg's not known for, you know, searching his soul in public. But, I mean, if you listen to his comments yesterday, it was a bridge too far. You know, essentially, I've got to be me, and I'm a Republican, and I have philosophical differences. And, yes, he does. But, you know,
what's
the
new
Obama
about that?
Administration said he was comfortable with the job and, you know, issued a pretty aggressive statement saying that he had sought it. You know, I'm not sure anyone comes out of this looking too good, though.
I mean, how does this play in New Hampshire in the sort of live free or die state? I mean, he, you know, was going to be a joiner, and now he's always going to have that moniker.
Well, I mean, that's definitely true. But Judd Gregg is definitely a born and bred Republican. You know, his father was a Republican governor. You know, he's a long record of fiscal conservatism. And he's been in office as a Republican in various positions since the 1980s. You know, some in the Republican Party are cheering him, saying essentially he's poked Obama in the eye. You know, he's certainly irreparably lost face with some in the party. And most people just think the whole situation was pretty weird to begin with, given given the philosophical differences the two men have.
Well, Josh, thanks for joining us. It's a real hit on bipartisanship, and we'll have to go to Washington, I suppose, to figure out what the implications are. I guess for me, I'm mystified. He mentioned Rahm Emanuel running things. He is the chief of staff. I mean, did he really think he wouldn't have to take a call from Rahm Emanuel? It's sort of
Well, I don't know what he thought. You know, a comment that the former Republican chairman in New Hampshire made to the Boston Globe in this morning's paper, I thought was interesting, that he said that he assumed Judd Gregg was a consenting adult when he took the position. You know, commerce has historically been a sort of a boosterish position. So, you know, perhaps he wasn't an ideal fit, but I guess we'll see where this goes. I mean, it's very strange.
Just needed to be himself. Josh Rogers, thanks so much. Reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio, reporting on the Judd Gregg decision.
I gotta be me. What else can I be but
Oh, yeah. You just gotta be me. Wouldn't you love to host a takeaway? Of course you would. It's the most fun job in America. Anyway, let's think now about your cell phone. What if it rang and this was the answer?
Baby, guess what? I'm pregnant. What do you mean? You're the only one I've been with for mad long.
That is actually a cell phone message that comes from a set of soap operas, a production technique which is being developed. And Fred Mogul, WNYC reporter here at station WNYC in New York, is here to report on a new mode of transmitting messages about safe sex to teenagers using cell phones. That's actually a piece of a soap opera, right, Fred?
Right. This is actually a part of a $2 million study. That's from the pilot that they developed, a 45-minute pilot that came out a few years ago that led to a $2 million NIH grant to develop a whole series, a dozen 15-minute installments that they're going to send to women. They're going to start with a select group, and they're going to see how they react to it. The whole idea is, will they or won't they change their behavior? Will they use condoms, in fact, when some of them, at least to get into this group, are sort of resistant to using condoms?
Now, of course, to deliver healthcare information, whether you're talking about, you know, Africa or, you know, communities in the United States where people need to know about safe practices, whether it's sanitation or, in this case, safe sex, you need to deliver the message to the place where the target population actually pays attention. Is there enough evidence that kids or the people that are targeted here pay enough attention to their cell phone to actually receive these messages?
Well, first of all, cell phones have come a long way. Not all of them can handle video just yet. You need to get the right model. They're distributing these models to the women in the study. And this is really a new sort of thing. They're taking 15-minute installments. And it's a show you can take and watch anywhere. And they're hoping that it will work on women, particularly in the African-American, Latino, urban community. These are people that that people who work on the healthcare providers on the front lines see coming back, getting infected, reinfected, even though they know in their hearts and minds that they should be having protected sex.
So they know the information. This is more of a reminder. Let's turn you from healthcare reporter, which is what you do here at WNYC, into a TV critic. All right. What have you got?
Well, you know, I'm not the target audience. These are people who are sort of amenable to soap operas in the first place. You know, this is kind of not exactly Oscar-winning drama. But they found that women who have watched the pilot kind of get into it, and they're trying to flip a switch in them in a way because they're hearing that message consciously. You can't be a sentient being and not know a little bit about condoms.
All right, well, let's go directly into the scene.
What are you doing? Baby, you know the deal. No glove, no love.
Baby, it's just that you look, feel, smell so good.
I know. Give me the condom. You'll like it when I put it on.
It's not pulling any punches there in the morning, but
this is pretty raunchy stuff. It's sort of just this side of softcore, but they're trying to root this in the real life experience of the women. In fact, these scripts are all come out of extensive focus groups. They're tested and tweaked, and they're saying, you know, this is different than every other campaign that you might see. You know, kind of at the other end of the spectrum, we'll maybe hear something from a wildly broadcast campaign in India coming up in a second. But this here, they're really rooted in.
So this has actually been tried. This has actually been tried before in another population. Let's take a look at. You described that this is a research project. This isn't some sort of fringy media foray. Here's the principal investigator who's actually taking a look at what's being tested in this project.
But in my studies, women who did perceive their partner to engage in risk behaviors were not so trustful of that partner. And yet we're still engaging in unprotected sex with him. And wherever we went, women were saying the same things, and that is to get a man and to hold on to a man, unprotected sex is what's expected.
And that's the message they're fighting, right?
Right. That's in a very specific milieu. You know, it's a part of the world where women are having trouble keeping a man, and somehow they've gotten into this dynamic where the men expect and demand unprotected sex, and they're trying to empower the women. That, by the way, I should say that's Rachel Jones, the principal investigator of the study.
Right, the principal investigator of the study. And, you know, as you said a moment ago, this has been tried before. What are we listening to here?
Right, so these are life-size dancing condoms in India. You will see this anywhere you go currently in India. So they're telling their audience, I am the condom friend ever useful to you. I am the condom friend ever useful to you. They're multicolored and they're telling you how fragrant they are. This is a little different. A different approach, you know, what the women in New Jersey and out of Rutgers and out of Newark and Jersey City, some pretty rough areas, really trying to say that these other campaigns that you might see, the more conventional safe sex things, you know, just aren't working. So
the mission is to get the message to be ubiquitous, to be where the kids are, and whether you're talking about Rachel Jones, that investigator from Rutgers University who's part of this study, or actually getting the stories on cell phones, it's about ubiquity of the message. Even if it's sensitive, if it gets into the discussion, it has a chance to work. Fred Mogul, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Fred Mogul, healthcare reporter for WNYC, talking about the use of cell phones to deliver safe sex messages to young people. Remember, keep sending us your stimulus stories, the economic stimulus, that is. We want to hear what's needed in your neighborhood. And here's a takeaway.
Banks are not going to lend as we hope they do, and the sort of wheels of commerce don't keep moving. So, this is ultimately not about the banks. It's about the economy and people.
Are all banks bad? That's Steve Lohr from our partner, The New York Times. Tomorrow's Valentine's Day, folks. Is it better to be in a relationship or to be single? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And have a happy Valentine's Day. I'm John Huckabee. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Sort of just this side of softcore.
A late-night tragedy near Buffalo, New York.
Either state police or sheriff's department need to find out if anything is on the ground. This aircraft was 5 miles out, and all of a sudden we have no response to that aircraft.
No survivors as a commuter plane crash lands short of the runway in Buffalo last night. A house was hit. The plane devastated a residential neighborhood. Rescuers say things could have been much worse. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
We could see the house actually in the fire, but there were so many explosions and so many little bits of ash and stuff blowing out that you didn't want to get close.
Mary Jane Luce lives near the site of the crash. She told CBS News that she kept her distance. One person on the ground in that Buffalo suburban neighborhood was also killed. Two people are being treated for injuries. No word so far on what caused the crash. Much more on the program today. We'll discuss the economy's effect on national intelligence and how the stimulus package could help urban transit. Those stories coming up. But first, Richard Hake, filling in for Femi Oke, has more details on the crash and other headlines.
That's right, John. Good morning. As you mentioned, we're following the crash of that Continental commuter jet near Buffalo very closely. Federal investigators are expected to brief us on the situation very shortly. We will keep you updated as we hear more. Also, just getting some news over the wires from Gaza. Palestinian officials say an Israeli airstrike killed one man and wounded another. Well, it's not you. It's me.
It is?
Well, maybe it is you, too. That's what New Hampshire Republican Senator Judd Gregg is saying to the Obama administration. He removed his name from consideration to be the next Commerce Secretary. He says there is lots of reasons for the breakup.
Well, the stimulus package is sort of a catalyst, but it's really not at the essence of the problem or the issue. The issue is philosophy and purpose and how you be how you serve an administration versus being an independent individual within the Congress.
Issues. I guess those come up a lot in relationships around Valentine's Day.
But a breakup story there.
Right. Really, well, nice. President Obama doesn't have any hard feelings, he says. He says the senator's withdrawal won't deter him from trying to work with the GOP. Meanwhile, the revised $789 billion stimulus may come to a final vote today. It could happen in both chambers. The wait may be a little bit longer in the Senate as lawmakers wait for Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, who's returning from his mother's wake in his home state. There's been another deadly bombing attack against Shiite pilgrims just south of Baghdad. Iraqi police say 35 people were killed and dozens more injured. It's the third straight day in which pilgrims have been targeted. Also, Australian police have charged a man with deliberately lighting one of those deadly wildfires that tore through the country's south. One Australian police commissioner, Christine Nixon, said people should keep an eye out for other suspects.
It's a part of the psychology of criminals to, you know, follow the behaviour of others. And so it's part of the reason we keep asking the community to be very aware of what's going on, to see if there are people in their area suspicious or they've got concerns, then to make sure they contact us.
The suspect's lawyer says he was in a fragile mental state.
Thank you, Richard. Leon Panetta is now the CIA director. The S&P begins at 8:35, trading today. Tomorrow's Valentine's Day. Here's a story. Mary says on our email, I have vivid memories of crying on Valentine's Day with my college boyfriend at an expensive restaurant I didn't even like. It was an ordeal. She throws ladies' cocktail parties these days. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. News-filled program this morning. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away. We are following the plane crash in suburban Buffalo, New York. Continental Flight 3407 crash-landed short of the runway. No survivors, 50 dead, one of them in a house that the plane hit. There's a news conference going on right now, and we'll keep you updated on the details. Richard Hake, of course, is following everything. It seems as though all of Washington, all of America, is trying to determine the implications of the economic downturn. Certainly, the stimulus package is all about addressing the economic downturn, and we want your stimulus package suggestions and stories and investigations at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're deputizing you to be investigators and sort of amateur economists. But there are implications to other than just the economy from the economic downturn. What about national intelligence? This is something raised by National Intelligence Director Dennis Blair speaking to a Senate panel yesterday.
economic crises increase the risk of regime-threatening instability if they are prolonged for a 1 or 2 year period. And instability can loosen the fragile hold that many developing countries have on law and order, which can spill out in dangerous ways into the international community.
Does financial instability mean political instability and, more than that, an increase in the possibility of things like terrorism? Joining us now is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent of The New York Times and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts on the Challenges to American Power. David Sanger, thanks for joining us.
Good to be back with you, John.
So what do you make of Dennis Blair? He's National Intelligence Director. He's laying out a pretty broad agenda and suggesting that instability economically is an opportunity for terrorists and people that want to destabilize the world. How does that work exactly?
Well, first, just step back and think about what a change this was. Dennis Blair was giving what's called the annual National Threat Assessment, an annual presentation in front of Congress about what are the major threats facing the United States, international threats. So from 2001 forward, we all knew what that was, John. It was terrorism, terrorism, and then terrorism. And all of a sudden you change administrations, and he's stepping up and saying, yeah, terrorism's a major issue, and we'll get on in a moment to what he said about al-Qaeda and the Taliban and so forth. But he said the number one issue for us here is that if you get a prolonged downturn, and it looks like this will be, it's the marginal countries that end up falling off the shelf, weak countries, and that makes them much more susceptible to all kinds of forces inside that can spill outside their borders. And, you know, we know this is true because even in good times, many of the countries that we're dealing with as our biggest problems are either failed states or near-failed states. Think Afghanistan, think Pakistan, you know, the list can go on. Think North Korea.
Well, let's take Afghanistan out of the picture for a minute because I think it's a special case given what's happened since 2001, but I do want to return to it. I mean, we've seen the proliferation of failed states even during the prosperity of the last 8 years. Remember back then when there was prosperity? But take, for example, Congo and areas of Central Africa where there is profound instability. Certainly there is a moral argument for intervening to restore law and order, but it's not as though people in states like Congo and Rwanda and maybe parts of even Kenya are targeting the United States in a way that Americans would feel threatened by. Explain.
That's right. And, you know, that's why, you know, Afghanistan and Pakistan are high up on the list. But he linked this to an interesting point, and you hear this when you read media across the world. Let's face it, this crisis started here. Okay, I mean, that's just a fact. And, you know, we can argue about whether or not it started with bad lending in Florida and California or whether it started with bad judgments on Wall Street, but it started here. And think of the power of that message abroad. Why are we running out of food, water, whatever? Because the Americans messed up the global economy.
Oh, that's an interesting take. So really, it's a hearts and minds issue all of a sudden, and we've got some work to do in the new administration.
Well, it's a hearts and minds issue, but also if you're a terror group looking for advantage and looking to blame the big bad United States for something, they've been handed a great arguing point because we can't get back and say, well, no, actually, this didn't begin here because it did. Hmm. Now, that doesn't mean that it started there with a intent to hurt anybody else or even ourselves, but the fundamental fact is true, and Admiral Blair said as much yesterday and said that the biggest concern that he had right now was almost a reputational one for the United States. He referred to how there was a, quote, increased questioning of U.S. stewardship of the global economy. Well, that's an understatement.
Well, you know, there's an irony there, because after 9/11, there was lots of propaganda out of al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda, you know, sound-alikes who wanted to bring down Wall Street. And there was a lot of talk about targeting Wall Street by blowing up the World Trade Center. The irony, of course, is, 10 years later, we've done it to ourselves economically. I'm wondering if there's a silver lining in the sense that certain terror organizations can say, see, we were right. It was fate that brought down the U.S. economy, and while they can take credit for what's happened to American prosperity, they're not necessarily going to do anything more about it.
Well, that would be an optimist viewpoint. You know, the other possibility is that they see America as more vulnerable and weaker and tired by Iraq and distracted by the economic crisis, and thus not truly seeking to go out and pursue them as thoroughly. And, you know, he mentioned, Admiral Blair mentioned, that, you know, it's also a problem with our allies. I mean, think about the next couple of months. You're going to have President Obama stepping out, trying to convince European allies, others, to step up the fight in Afghanistan and many other places. And what are they going to come back and say? We not only have a political problem with this, we now have an economic problem.
Hmm.
Committing these forces.
So what does this mean? You know, law and order, when someone like Dennis Blair talks about law and order in, you know, marginal regimes around the United States, to a lot of people in the world, that means supporting dictators who are holding on with an iron fist in countries that are about to spring apart for various reasons. Does this argue for helping dictators or helping people who have a kind of ruthless hold on their countries or some other sort of policy?
Well, it may. It also argues for greater development work, you know, in the poorest parts of the world. And you're going to see in Congress, I think next week, the introduction of the bill for significant financing to begin to do rebuilding in the tribal areas of Pakistan. And one of the areas that he mentioned has gotten significantly worse. This is a bill that goes back to something that then-Senator Obama and then-Senator Biden and others introduced last summer. But imagine after we've just gone through what we're going to do, $800 billion tonight, right, on the fiscal stimulus. We have a banking plan that we're headed to that's probably going to be, you know, $2 trillion-plus. So the enthusiasm for committing significant funds and energy to the tribal areas of Pakistan is probably going to be pretty limited.
Right. One final point, and that is in a time of global economic crisis, doesn't that affect terrorist groups and guerrilla organizations as well, in that, you know, the Osama bin Ladens of the world are, you know, probably looking at their bank accounts. It's not as though they invested with Madoff, but they're probably looking at downturns just like everyone else.
You know, they may be. There are many who believe that actually what hurts them the most is the decline in the price of oil, because over the years, a lot of the extremist groups have been financed by people who benefit a lot when oil is high. And, you know, Denny Blair did have some good news. He said that he thought that al-Qaeda had probably suffered more in the past year from these predator strikes we've been doing than been hurt more than at any time since the invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. But at the same time, he mentioned, you know, marginal countries. I mentioned North Korea before as an example of a country that could find itself so over the edge that the temptation to go out and sell their one major product, which in their case is their nuclear weapons technology, could be higher than ever.
So the incentive to actually get nukes into the mix probably goes up in a time like this when people are cash-starved.
People are always willing to pay for nukes. That's one of the things you learn about the black market. You know, AQ Khan got rich doing something, right?
So there's a growth area somewhere, a boom time for black market nukes. We'll leave it there on that optimistic note from David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent of The New York Times and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. Economic instability increases the likelihood of terrorism in some unlikely spots. That last note there, boom times for black market nukes. Thank you, David, and we'll be right back.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to have some more details about the reversal of fortune for bipartisanship in Washington as New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg takes himself out of the running to be Secretary of Commerce. He's a Republican senator, of course, in a Democratic administration. An attempt on bipartisanship goes sour. We'll have more on that in a moment. But the thing about the justice system, it's supposedly a system designed to apply moral principles to people accused of criminality. And the juvenile justice system is all about rehabilitation and bringing people back and restoring people to civilian life or non-prison life. But there's a shocker in the New York Times this morning from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. A class action lawsuit charges that hundreds of children and their families were sent to privately run detention centers in an alleged scam that looks like literally trafficking in defendants, where judges funneled defendants from their cases to specific private prisons who then delivered kickbacks to the judges. Ian Urbino from The New York Times has the story on the front page of The Times. This is about as shocking a story that represents as much of a contradiction to what the principles of justice are supposed to be as I've ever read. Ian, lay out the details as best as you know them.
Well, so the two judges at hand pled guilty yesterday. They pled to having engaged in a scheme from 2002 to 2006 in which they initially set up a relationship between the courthouse and a project to build two detention centers, and they cleared the way for the building of those centers. And then subsequently they began essentially funneling the kids that they were sentencing to the centers, all for a hefty, you know, $2.6 million kickback over the years. And the detention centers get paid only if their beds are filled. And the judge specifically who was overseeing the sentencing part had become pretty infamous in the state for handing down draconian sentences for minor infractions, often or sometimes even against the advice of prosecutors and probation officers. And now we see why.
So this is a judge making a political stand by being sort of a hard-nosed sentencer, getting money specifically for sending kids to facilities that he has a financial interest in. The facilities get state reimbursement for having more and more convicts in their beds. Where do the children fit in here? And it sounds as though guilt or innocence or rehabilitation was no part of any of the sentences that produced this $2.6 million.
Yeah, I mean, where the children fit in was as victims, essentially. I mean, this is a juvenile court in Luzerne County. And as you said in your opening, its real goal is to steer these kids back. Instead, you know, he was handing down sentences that didn't really deserve detention time, and very long sentences at that, you know, in juvenile terms. So what would normally get a stern lecture and a slap on the wrist got, you know, 3 months in the detention center. And if you're, you know, a junior, sophomore in high school, there's certainly the stigma that's really going to affect you, but there's also the missed time from school that can completely ruin your career.
Mean, there's any number of things. I mean, you've talked to these kids. What have they told you, and how are they responding to these revelations?
Yeah, I mean, every story from the kids started out with a tale of courtroom shock. You know, the kids and their parents went to the courtroom expecting not what occurred, and most of the stories ended with the kids being often shackled, you know, wrist and ankles, and led out of the courtroom immediately.
And, in several of the kids' cases, one kid in particular I talked to, he got back to school and he had a pretty 3.6, 3.7 average before this happened. He's a pretty straight kid. He stuck up for a girl in the hallway who was getting bullied, and he shoved a kid against a locker. Kid got stitches. Parents filed charges, and this kid was sent away for 3 months. And when he got back to school, he was way behind, and, he was, depressed, and he eventually dropped out of high school. So they're pretty textbook cases of tragedy.
I mean, that's just hard even to listen to. These are scars that last a lifetime, and for a chunk of $2.6 million in cash. Is there any sense, and a lot of people in your piece have described this as something they've never seen ever before, so there's, it's not as though this is going on everywhere in the United States, but is this possible more in a juvenile setting where the judge seems to have more latitude and autonomy?
That's a good question, and it's one that a lot of people are asking. I think the theory that would support that is that because juvenile courts are closed courts, and they're closed for good reason. They're meant to be separated from the media and the public so as to protect the privacy of these kids so that they're not stigmatized for the rest of their lives. But since they're closed, it's a very small set of people who know what happens in them. Child advocates have raised worries about that before. But the second issue is a larger issue, and that is this notion of waiving the right to counsel. In 1967, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that juveniles have the right to counsel. But the way that that's carried out varies state to state and even county to county. And in many counties, in fact, most counties across the country, children or at least their parents, but in many places like Pennsylvania, children themselves can waive the right to counsel. And often they are sort of browbeaten by judges or others into doing so,
wow.
Or they feel that way.
It's an amazing story. Go to thenewyorktimes.com or pick up a copy of The Times. It's on the front page. Ian Urbino, reporting on the story of young children in juvenile court vulnerable to a scam where judges were funneling young people to private prison facilities where the judges got kickbacks and the facilities got state reimbursement. Ian, thanks so much. Incredible reporting.
Thank you.
And quick headlines from Richard Hake here.
And John, the investigation...
Just about the plane crash. What
the investigation just getting underway outside of Buffalo, New York, the site of that deadly crash. 50 people dead after a Continental commuter turboprop crashed into a home in a residential neighborhood. Local officials can't even get close to it. There's a natural gas leak fueling the fire
still
at the site
on.
Right now.
More details later. Thank you, Richard Hake.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. About 13, 14 years ago, I was in a no relationship, really. I decided to celebrate Valentine's Day by going out with someone I was not dating, and we'd both sort of celebrate that we were not couples and that, we were not in a relationship. 13 years later, I'm actually married to that woman. So what's your Valentine's Day story? Are you in a relationship or not? Which is better, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org? So you can almost imagine the conversation between Barack Obama and Republican Senator Judd Gregg as Judd Gregg took his name out of consideration to be Commerce Secretary.
Not you. It's me.
You're giving me the it's not you, it's me routine?
Actually, the real conversation probably went more like this. Here is Senator Gregg announcing his decision to withdraw as Commerce Secretary. Bipartisanship, not this time.
You know, I'm a fiscal conservative, as everybody knows, fairly strong one. And it just became clear to me that it would be very difficult day in and day out to serve in this cabinet or any cabinet for that matter.
How long did he have to think about that? That's really the question for Charles Mattesi, a national politics editor for Politico.com. Charles, thanks for joining us from Maryland. What was it that Judd Gregg learned, like, within the last 24 hours that he didn't know when he was asked and actually tried to get this position?
Well, John, I think that's really the Obama administration's question that they'd want to ask right now, because, you know, there was something very interesting in the way it played out yesterday, and if you give a close parsing or a Washington read to the Press Secretary Robert Gibbs' statement, you begin to see that, where they talk about the fact that Senator Gregg and the president had discussions about these various issues, that he seemed amenable to it, and that he actually seemed to be soliciting the job actively, and then all of a sudden he pulled the plug on it. And so I think it's a pretty legitimate question to ask, you know, what changed? Because nothing really did. I think in the end, though, as these concerns mounted in Senator Gregg's mind, as he was confronted with questions from unhappy Democrats about the census and his positions on the census, and as he heard probably from former colleagues, or actually still colleagues on the Hill, he really began to have some deep reservations about moving forward.
Now, you mentioned the census. The idea that a disagreement over the census is a deal breaker is a little bit of a mystery to me. Could you elaborate on that one?
Well, here's the thing about the census. I mean, most people would think, you know, it's a pretty nonpartisan thing. All you do is count noses, right? But actually, there's a tremendous amount of politics because of the implication of the census, and it's very meaningful to both parties, because the Commerce Department has jurisdiction over the Census Bureau, and what's at the heart of this is, as a result of concerns among Democrats about Judd Gregg taking over at Commerce, the administration said that the White House would be asserting greater control over the census. This, of course, freaked out Republicans because they understand that the outcome has deep political implications because congressional districts are determined on the basis of population, federal funding formulas are determined on the basis of population, and Democrats and Republicans have very different ideas about how we should count and how we should look into situations of undercounting and things
I
like
see.
That.
So a prelude to a reapportionment battle that's a perennial, you know, every decade kind of an issue here. I'm wondering personally, focusing on Senator Gregg, and I know you're familiar with his career, is this at all an issue of, you know, on second thought, maybe I'd rather be a big fish in a small pond called New Hampshire rather than a small fish in the Rahm Emanuel shark tank?
Well, you know, I think ultimately it's less about that because, I mean, he had served three terms, John, as a senator from New Mexico. He's a former governor. I think his dad was even a governor in New Hampshire. He's a former member of the House. So he's had a very long and rich career. So I don't know that, you know, he there's that much more he wants to accomplish on the Hill. I think in the end, though, you know, there was just mounting evidence that he just couldn't get past. There was almost nothing where they were philosophically aligned, whether it was the census, whether it was some of the provisions in the stimulus package, because after all, he's a guy who really built a reputation as a fiscal conservative. I mean, he was no wavering moderate. He was
right.
Not somebody who was considered what the Republicans call an extreme squish. And so I think probably the more that came out about the recovery package, the more uncomfortable he got. And he also mentioned that there were some items, some issues surrounding the health care debate and possibly even global
right.
warming that he had some problems with.
You know, Extreme Squish, that was one of the candidates for the name of this show when we were doing the piloting of it, Extreme Squish. I'm glad that you brought that up. Charles, it seems as though this whole circumstance kind of puts the lie to bipartisanship in a sense that bipartisanship is an attempt to deny what Judd Gregg actually said. I've got to be me. It's about identity. It's be myself. It really doesn't work, this bipartisanship.
Yeah, I think despite what we heard on the campaign trail from the Obama administration, and despite some very genuine and sincere-seeming overtures from the Obama administration to the other side, you know, bipartisanship looks pretty dead. And if it's not dead, it looks to be on life support. Because if you take a look at the, you know, the first month of Barack Obama's term, you really begin to see that really not much has changed in terms of the toxic environment on Capitol Hill. And it's, you know, no one really expected that to change, and no one expected that the president would be able to change things very quickly or very easily on the Hill. But I think even so, it's pretty startling that neither party has been able to sort of give up the old ways of doing business. And you see that in ways that are both large and small on Capitol Hill these days.
Well, there are two parties, that's for sure. Charles Mattesian, thanks so much. National politics editor for Politico.com.
Thanks for having me.
Gotta be me. What else can I be?
Oh, Sammy, sing it. And Richard Hake has the headlines.
And John, good morning to you. It is now 21 minutes before the top of the hour. Our top story this morning, the rubble of the home and what's left of a plane are still smoking near Buffalo, New York, where a Continental commuter turboprop crashed into a neighborhood late last night, killing all 49 people on board. A person in the home that was struck by the plane was also killed. It's the nation's first fatal crash of a commercial airliner in 2.5 years. Steve Chelander is with the National Transportation Safety Board, and all morning long it's been actually too hot for investigators to go in and look through the rubble.
We've been allowed by the incident commander to go in and try to retrieve the black boxes, if you will, the two recorders, the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder.
Besides that, they haven't been able to begin their investigation quite yet. In other stories, in Zimbabwe, just days after MDC opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai was sworn in as prime minister, a senior opposition official and ministerial nominee has been arrested. Roy Bennett, the MDC's choice to become deputy agriculture minister, was reportedly seized at an airport. Bennett was supposed to participate in a ceremony to swear in a new unity cabinet. Circuit City is headed to bankruptcy court today looking for approval to auction off its remaining properties. Those include 567 U.S. stores, the company's corporate headquarters, and various distribution centers.
You can see the signs in all those Circuit Cities.
There's one in my neighborhood that was gone a couple months ago.
I know. There's a couple of big screen TVs. It's sort of sad. A couple of big screen TVs and some shelves. That's it. Well, the reality of an economic downturn. Thank you, Richard Hake.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. So it's Friday the 13th right now, but tomorrow it's Valentine's Day. And is your plan to get candy for your loved one? In Washington state, it's actually a serious statewide political issue, the idea of having a state candy. Megan Sealing, staff writer of local alternative weekly The Stranger, joins us from Seattle, Washington, to talk about the state of Washington contemplating a decision to make an official state candy. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
Explain this political issue.
Well, it's funny, and I think it was just presented more as like a lighthearted thing, but there is a representative here, Mike Armstrong, who presented the House Bill 1024 to make Applets and Cotlets the official candy of Washington State.
You don't have an official candy?
We don't, no.
Is
we
that
have official everything,
people
so it makes sense.
So people walk around and feel an enormous deficit in their lives that there has not been a state candy up till this time?
I would assume so, yeah, yeah, definitely. And they tried to make a state candy before in the past with almond roca. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Oh, got some right here. Got some right here.
And it didn't pass. Like, they just didn't go for it. And I think the reasoning there was just maybe it was unnecessary. And so they tried it again with applets and cotlets now, which are made in eastern Washington using fruit trees. They have hundreds of acres of orchards over there with pears and apples. And so it's all locally grown ingredients, but they're still, I don't know, they're kind of gooey and not all that interesting. So.
Well, so you've had applets and cotlets.
Yeah.
Well, and you don't really like
them. Washington, yeah. And they're a part of my childhood for sure, but I don't know if I'd want them representing the state so much. They're a little undignified.
Is this an applet and cotlet? I'm looking now in the control room. Is this an applet and cotlet that I'm holding in my hand? Right. It's a square powdered sugary thing. Feels a little spongy.
Uh-huh. It's a lot like Turkish Delight.
Okay, I'll eat a crumb one here. Well, to the people of Washington, I say, that's delicious. But to you, Megan, I say, it's a little scary.
Yeah.
It is a little bit.
They're definitely, they're a big part of life and culture and growing up here for sure. But yeah, they're a little, gooey and they're a little weird. And
we could look at this as kind of an economic stimulus package. The government weighing in and trying to insource a product, make sure that it's made in Washington and the people in Washington buy it whenever they can.
Right.
What do you think the economic value of having a state candy is?
I don't know that there is one. And that's why I think it was presented just kind of for fun. I don't know that it would have any big boom in the candy industry if we were to declare something the state candy. Like apples and cutlets, it's nationally known and shipped throughout the U.S., but so are so many other candies that are locally made here. I don't know that it would make much of a difference. So if that was their reasoning, I think it was sort of a fail.
Finally, the question really is, and I suspect that you've encountered this as a staff writer at The Stranger, that the people are maybe a little bit concerned that in this time of economic woe, why is the Washington legislature dealing with this?
Oh, yeah. There's absolutely been some backlash. Like, is this what we really need to be focusing on right now? And I think, why not? There's already enough bad news and there's already enough concern and worry. Throwing something fun on the table definitely isn't going to mess anything up, I don't think. It's not going to be a negative repercussion.
All right, well, suddenly we're getting a little personal reveal from you, Megan, because you're pro-state candy.
Yes. I'm pro any candy, to be honest.
Megan Sealing, she's a staff writer at The Stranger, covering the story of Washington State considering making applets and cotlets, a locally produced candy in Washington, the state candy. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Too much, too soon, too little, too late. Two economic questions of relevance as Congress prepares to finally pass the stimulus bill in the House and Senate. David Lanard's going to talk to us in a moment. But first, a last look at the headlines from our own Richard Hick, filling in for Femi Okay.
And John, good morning to you. It's 12 minutes before the top of the hour. Federal investigators are now on scene of that plane crash right outside of Buffalo, about 10 miles. It killed 50 people late last night. The plane was en route from Newark Airport when it crashed into a neighborhood in bad weather right on top of a house. A board member of the National Transportation Safety Board, Steve Chelander, spoke to the media just a little while ago. They're apparently in the fact-finding mission, which is looking for evidence.
The fire is very hot. It's still burning out there. The incident commander is in control. He's the one that tells us when we can go in and start our investigation. So as far as picking up pieces and getting all the things that we need to get to conduct our investigation, we haven't begun that yet.
All 49 people on the aircraft died. Also, one person on the ground. That person was in the house. Two people did manage to escape from that. In other stories, the $790 billion economic stimulus plan is on track for a vote today in the House. The plan was delayed over a disagreement on school construction funds. The president says the measure will create or save 3.5 million jobs, but critics say the bill is filled with wasteful spending and won't boost the economy. A Texas peanut plant has been shut down and all of its products recalled. State health officials say inspectors found dead rodents and feathers in the Peanut Corporation of America plant in Plainview, Texas. The national company is under federal criminal investigation.
Not appetizing at all. Thank you, Richard Hague.
You're welcome.
So from macro to micro, when Congress passes the economic stimulus package, all of the big high-minded talk will be translated into small packets of dollars headed out to various localities, states and localities, and individual projects, and the wallets of individual taxpayers, $789 billion worth. And so the test of what all that rhetoric was about will be done on all of us here in the U.S. economy. And joining us to discuss the economics of the stimulus package as we learn the details and read the fine print is David Leonhard of the New York Times, who joins us from Washington. David, thanks so much for taking some time out to participate in this discussion. I mean, do you think this stimulus package is, just bottom line, good economics?
I think it's a mix of good economics and bad economics. I think there is more good than bad, but I'm even a little bit uncomfortable saying that because I wish we didn't need a stimulus package, and even a stimulus package of this size isn't going to solve our problems. So I think there are going to be times when it's going to feel as if this didn't do it, but my guess is it's going to make a significant difference, that if we could live through an alternate reality without the stimulus package, it would be much worse.
Well, you know, those days are gone, and I want to talk about sort of the broad implications of all the money that we're spending maybe before we end, but let's start with math for a second. I mean, it seems to me that in the lead up to this vote, economic statistics on unemployment indicate that if you add up everybody who's in the sort of less than employed category, you got 13 million people. This plan will affect directly, in the best case scenario, 3.6 million, I believe, if I've got the numbers right. And Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, was saying just the other day that there's something on the order of a $2.5 trillion demand hole in the economy.
Yeah.
And this is only $780 billion total. It just seems like it's bound to fall short. Am I wrong?
No, you're not. I think it's easiest to think of these numbers in annual terms, and they basically end up in a similar place to where you were. But there's about a $1 trillion annual hole in the economy, probably in 2009 and 2010. And this is probably going to plug $300, $350 billion of it a year. And that is by no means plugging the full hole. Now, what the people in the Obama administration will say is, that this isn't the only thing they're doing. The TARP, the housing bailout, the stuff they're trying to do with other countries, the fact that the Fed has cut the interest rate, which tends to take effect slowly, now to zero, that those things will all help fill the hole. And it's also true that the government really shouldn't try to fill the entire hole, right? We don't have the government here to prevent recessions. You can't prevent recessions. It's not really a good idea to try. You just want to keep the hole from being so deep that it causes even more pain than it otherwise would, and also that you don't want it to cause a self-reinforcing cycle. All that said, I still am not sure the stimulus package is big enough.
Right.
You know, in the end, you mentioned 3.6 million jobs. I think that was one of the early estimates. Because of the way it was shrunk, I think the newer estimates about how many jobs it's going to save or create are more like 2.5.
Wow. You know, let's go into the more impressionistic elements here. And I know you constantly warn and are whacking me upside the head when I try to make comparisons with the Depression or the 1930s. And I don't want to necessarily directly do that. But, you know, I started my reporting career out in the West Coast, where during the 1930s, huge public works projects were built that are permanent, almost like the significance of the pyramids today, the dams on the Columbia River, the rural electrification projects. I'm looking at this plan, and as historic as it seems to be, at the end of the day, there's not going to be one big thing that we point to that we can all say as Americans, wow, at least we did that. This thing seems very, very piecemeal and on the fringe.
Yes. I agree that it's not ambitious enough on some of those scores. With that being said, there are a few really encouraging things in it. And I had this funny feeling yesterday. I was looking through a copy of the list of it, and I saw it was a list of what it's being spent on. And I saw a 1 next to this comparative effectiveness research thing for healthcare. And you see the number 1, and you think, well, that's nothing. It's tiny. In a bill of 800, what's 1? And then I realized, that's $1 billion. That's actually a lot of money. And so I think the most encouraging things from on your terms on the, you know, will we remember this, are the healthcare stuff. It's going to spend something like $16 billion or so to install electronic medical records. And I don't think in the future we'll look back and think of electronic medical records as some great public work, but we may look back and think that we stopped wasting enormous amounts of money on healthcare that doesn't actually make people healthy. And electronic medical records are a key part of that. Hmm. And the second thing in it is, at the very end, they increased high-speed rail, funding for high-speed rail up to $8 billion. And, you know, it's insane that we don't have better high-speed rail in this country. I mean, it takes what, more than 6 hours to get from Washington to Boston by train?
But $8 billion isn't going to give us much track. A lot of blueprints, maybe.
It won't give us a huge amount of track, but it's a lot better than what we've got. So I agree with you. This isn't gonna build one of these amazing monuments. The question is it gonna do nothing?
Historians, of course, say at the end of the 1930s, the real stimulus package was World War II. Do you see anything on the horizon of that scale that could help turn this economy around?
This has become a really interesting debate about whether the New Deal worked and what ended the Depression. I think when you look at the economics, there's no question that the New Deal worked. The problem was parts of it didn't, but there's no question that on the whole it did. The problem is that there wasn't enough of it. Bruce Bartlett, a conservative writer, has an interesting piece on Forbes' website today making this case. It wasn't that the New Deal didn't work and then the war did. It's that the New Deal started to work and then the war was this massive fiscal stimulus that finished the job. I really hope we're not facing another war of any kind. I also hope that we get to the point of having the kind of fiscal response we need much more quickly this time, because we're able to look back at the lesson of the Depression and say the problem was that they weren't aggressive enough.
David Leonhard, thanks so much for joining us. David Leonhard is an economics reporter for the New York Times in Washington, discussing whether this stimulus package is good economics or bad economics. And, you know, that's just one of the interviews on this morning's program that's worth the podcasting. You should go to our website, thetakeaway.org, and find out how to podcast any of the segments this morning. And 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org is the place to send us your stimulus stories. We want to hear what's needed in your neighborhood. Actually, the Obama administration is ripping off our idea on their website. They're also looking for your stories of where to spend stimulus money, how the economic downturn is affecting you in your neighborhood, and, you know, all that at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can also be part of our special project, Shovel Watch. When you see the stimulus money being spent in your town properly or improperly, go to our website, thetakeaway.org, and tell us. Here's your takeaway.
Bipartisanship looks pretty dead, and if it's not dead, it looks to be on life support, because if you take a look at the first month of Barack Obama's term, you really begin to see that really not much has changed in terms of the toxic environment on Capitol Hill.
That's Charles Mattesian, national politics editor for Politico.com. And a couple more voices from you.
Hi, my name is Beth. I'm married on Valentine's Day to a man who doesn't believe in Valentine's Day. He thinks it's very commercial, so of course I never get flowers, I never get candy, and I always feel neglected.
Somebody needs to do something for her.
Hi, this is Brian from South Carolina. We need to fire everybody in our government. That would be the greatest stimulus we could have.
Not exactly a Valentine's Day thought, but thanks anyway. 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.